Session number 4816, row 7.
Commander Moran, reel 7.
Well, the next thing we heard was a whistle blowing. This was the sentry on the bridge going over the moat, a whistle blowing. And shouts from this sentry to Mike, telling him to halt and stay where he was. And Mike was still shouting back. And a few minutes later, we heard running. And there must have been a dozen sentries came running, and surrounded Mike. And they were shouting at Mike. And it was always the same way when you got a crowd of sentries who were excited about something. They'd shout. And Mike was still threatening them, still claiming to be Franz Joseph, until Franz Joseph arrived. And we heard Franz Joseph down there. And the next thing we heard was a shot, just one single shot. And we didn't know what it was about until later. So we all our preparations, the chaps who were dressed up in civvies, and there were, what was it, six chaps all lined up waiting, because what Mike was going to do once he'd relieved these three chaps was to give the signal, and then the bars would be removed again and down the rope with these six chaps, and they'd all follow Mike, and the lot of them would be away. That was the object of the exercise. But a little later on, Eggers, accompanied by a sentry, came up into our quarters and told us that Mike Sinclair was wounded and was in hospital. And it was only somewhere about a fortnight before Mike came back. And he was very, very fortunate indeed. He got a bullet right through him, but it had missed everything vital. It had hit nothing vital, and there didn't seem to be any serious after effects at all.
It had gone through his chest or
yes,
shoulder.
Yes, indeed. But it had missed anything really vital. So he was extraordinarily fortunate there. But then, of course, as I may have mentioned before, Mike was killed in the end.
How was that?
Well, now, Mike was... Mike Sinclair was a sort of chap who there was nothing for him but escaping. And I think we all felt that it was a phobia with him. With most of us, it was, I suppose, something exciting, something intensely interesting, something exciting, and something, if it came off, would be, you know, really wonderful. I suppose we were, to a large extent, like men reliving their boyhood dreams. But with Mike, it was an absolute phobia. I think everyone was convinced that he felt, and I'm sure we were right, he felt that if the war ended and he hadn't escaped, he wouldn't be able to live with himself. This was Mike Sinclair. And that wasn't the end of his escaping efforts. He had two or three more attempts which got him nowhere, but all the time he was planning something. But the ultimate came in September 1944. Yes, September 1944. And by September 1944, although conditions in the camp had deteriorated very, very considerably in many ways. Insofar as food was concerned, it had deteriorated out of all recognition, A, because the Red Cross parcels weren't coming in, and B, because the German rations had gone down. We'd been reduced to a 20th of a loaf per man per day. In fact, the rations in the morning, you got either acorn coffee or mint tea. Whether the coffee was made out of acorns or not, I think, in fact, a lot of it was. And the tea, what that was made of, we used to reckon it was made out of hedgerow clippings, but whatever it was, ersatz coffee and ersatz tea, that's all we got in the morning. at midday you got your main rations for the day, and this was soup and your ration of bread and a few potatoes. And the soup invariably was called rabbi soup. Called rabbi is a field turnip. It's only grown normally throughout Europe as cattle feed. It's like a big mess of great big turnip, and called rabbi soup consisted of a bowl of coloured water, of yellowish water, with some pieces of kohlrabi floating about it. With that you got your potatoes, and they were boiled in their jackets. You got your potatoes, and this was, I suppose, about three medium-sized potatoes each, something like that, and a 20th of a loaf of bread, a little square of ersatz margarine. The margarine was made out of coal. And I think it was about once a week or twice a week we got a ration of jam. And this was ersatz jam as well. Occasionally, as to break the monotony, we got sauerkraut, but nobody could ever eat the sauerkraut. We tried all sorts of ways of eating it. This came in, the whole ration came in a big barrel. Nobody could eat the damn stuff. We tried boiling it, we tried frying it, we tried, you know, every possible way. And a lot of it was eaten because it bloody well had to be eaten. It was that or nothing. But I think perhaps the most useful quality that sauerkraut had, and I wasn't involved in it personally, except at the tail end of it, was that, one drew the rations on principle. I mean, even if you knew you couldn't eat the bloody stuff, even if you had to shove it down the loo and pull the chain, you drew them, you see, because, you know, this was a matter of principle. And if we didn't draw them, that leaves more for the Germans. And the big quality of the sauerkraut was that if it was left for a time, it started fermenting like fury. And it was a short step from there for people like Howard G and one or two more to use the stuff to ferment liquor from it. And they had one or two damn good stills going. But to compensate, if you can call it a compensation, for the deterioration in conditions, because privileges, so-called privileges, most of them were withdrawn. The chapel was closed to us. The theatre, room up at the top of the Saal House, we used to use as a theatre, and we used to get up shows, that was closed to us. We had extra appels. Instead of four appels a day, we had five standard appels a day. Searches got more and more severe. But the park, and we always called it the park, and if you can imagine the word park in inverted commas, in the the castle had quite large grounds, and down in the grounds of the castle was an area about the probably somewhere about the size of this garden. Perhaps a couple of hundred feet long by 100 feet wide, something like that, which is surrounded by barbed wire. And once a week, I'm not quite sure how often it was, but I think it was once a week, or maybe a bit, may have been more often, 30 chaps were allowed down there. And this was in itself a wonderful change from the courtyard, because instead of being cooped up in this bloody little bear pit, you were down there, you got grass under your feet, you got trees all around, and you ignored the barbed wire. I mean, one was used to barbed wire. And I remember this particular day. It's one of those instances that is always as clear as daylight. When the names, because the names of the chaps who wanted to go down were put forward the previous day, and there were a hell of a chaps who wouldn't, on the basis that, you know, the Germans had withdrawn so many rights and so many privileges that we're not going to take any favours from them at all. And this, I suppose, it was regarded by some people as a favour. I used to go down whenever I could because it was such a wonderful change from the courtyard, despite the limitations of the place. But on this particular occasion, as Mike Sinclair put his name down to go down, you know, nobody could understand this. One immediately said to oneself, "Well, why? No, why is he putting his name down?" And although one knew nothing about it, one couldn't help but feel, well, now Mike's got something on. No, Mike had to have something on because there was a reason for everything he did. And the usual drill, and we followed the usual drill that day, was at the, whatever the time was it in the afternoon? We used to go down there or the morning? I've really forgotten. But Eggers or Pupka came into the courtyard with a couple of sentries, and the 30 of us would line up there, and we'd be counted. And we went through the gate, the door from the courtyard to the passageway, alleyway outside, and there we were lined up in our threes again, and again counted. And the a signature was given for us, an exchange of signatures between the Germans. The chap who was taking over to march us down to the park had to sign for us. And we walked down there with guards down either side and a chap with a dog behind and a chap with a dog in front. And we walked down there. And every nook and cranny had its guard there. And down we went under one of these archways and turned left and down a track and so on, and every part of the place where there was the slightest possibility of a diversion had got an armed sentry there, until you got down to the castle grounds, and there was this barbed wire enclosure, and the gate was open, and we walked in. We had to line up in our threes there and were counted again, and we stood lined up in threes until the guards had got themselves around the perimeter, and a machine gun that end was manned, and a machine gun that end was manned. And then at the word go, we could disperse and, you know, do what we liked, sit down on the grass or kick a ball around or walk around, you see. And I was walking around on my own. And the park, and again, you know, park in inverted commas, this enclosure was sloping, not too steeply sloping, but sloping. There was inside the wire, there was a path all the way around that had been made by chaps walking round and round. I was walking around there, and I stopped at the top of the slope, just gazing out through the trees. And I suppose I was dreaming, thinking of what was beyond those trees, and imagining myself going beyond them and across the countryside to the Channel coast and and arriving home. This was, you know, no unusual sort of dream. And Mike Sinclair walked up behind me and stopped and said, in effect, "What the bloody hell have you stopped for, Mike? Can't you walk like everyone else?" And knowing Mike, as we all did, who was not an easy chap to get close to, I said, "Okay, Mike, if you'd rather I walk, I'll walk." So I carried on walking, and I walked around and down to the bottom there. I was just about down here when I heard a shout of "Halt!" And I glanced around. There was Mike starting to climb the bloody wire. This was the barbed wire around, which was, I don't know how high, not terribly high, perhaps 10 feet high. There was Mike starting to climb the bloody wire, and of course everybody had heard this shout of "Halt!" And everybody had stopped and looking around, and we're shouting out to Mike, "Mike, for Christ's sake, get down, Mike." And the Germans were shouting out, "Halt, halt! Halt, odorous Schießer!" And Mike took no bloody notice at all. They started climbing up, and the Germans, to give them their due at that moment, were still shouting out, "Halt, odorous Schießer! Stop or we fire." And Mike took no bloody notice, climbed to the top, jumped over the other side, and in the meantime, some of the guards were rousing us up. And Mike started running. We heard the shots being fired, a hell of a lot of shots being fired, but we were roused up. We couldn't. Mike had disappeared because the trees were scattered there. You know, it wasn't as if the trees were growing cheek by jowl. The trees scattered around, and Mike was running and dodging in between the trees, and we couldn't see what happened there. But we were roused up, and with guards all around us and rifles pointed at us, and we were hustled back to the car courtyard. No ceremony about it at all. We were hustled back inside, and the gates shut as usual. And of course, you can imagine what we were thinking, and what we were wondering at the time. And some time later, perhaps a couple of hours later, Eggers came into the courtyard, came in and went straight to see the SBO, Colonel Todd, and explained to Colonel Todd what had happened and asked Colonel Todd if he would call an appel. And it wasn't the normal sort of appel, because the normal sort of appel was a siren would go, and we knew what that siren meant. Well, this was clear lower decks, you know, everybody had to be down in the courtyard. But this was done by word of mouth. Various runners were sent to the various rooms to get everybody down below, and we're all lined up in the usual way. And Colonel Todd, Eggers, to give Eggers his due, he was there. You know, it must have been a very difficult situation for him. And Colonel Todd, I'm just trying to be absolutely straight on this, whether it was Colonel Todd who told us, who actually told us that Mike was dead, or whether it was Eggers. No, it wasn't. It was Eggers who told us. And my God, you know, we didn't think so at the time, but looking back now, my God, you know, I admire Eggers' guts in doing this, because the easy way out would have been to tell Colonel Todd and say whatever he'd got to say and let Colonel Todd tell us. But Eggers told us himself. And I remember this very clearly, that it was Eggers now, because Pete Tunstall, who was always in trouble, stepped out and called Eggers a murdering, bloody Deutscher Schweinhund. And immediately a couple of guards were told to arrest him, and he was marched off to cells. And immediately afterwards, David Hunter did just the same. He said, "I'm stepping forward to confirm that you are a lot of murdering German bastards," or words to that effect. He was marched off to cells, and they were both court-martialed for this. But that was Mike Sinclair. The Germans used to call him the Red Fox. An amazing history he had. He was one of the 1940 POWs. And now, that this was an all-embracing term, and one tended to classify people as 1940 prisoners, when so many were taken prisoner at Dunkirk and Calais and various other places around there. And he, way back at the end of 1940 or the beginning of 1941, he was being sent to a prisoner of war camp in Poland, and there were quite a number in Poland, and he jumped the train there, literally jumped from a moving train. He clued up with the partisans in Poland, and he was with the partisans for about a year, until the Gestapo got hold of him. And he had a pretty rough time with the Gestapo, as anybody did who fell into the hands of the Gestapo, because he'd been working with the partisans. But eventually he was able, as a number were, to be reinstated, if that's the word, as a prisoner of war, to be given back his POW status. And he found himself in Kolbitz. So that was Mike Sinclair. And whenever one thinks back on Kolbitz, there are a number of faces that immediately come to mind. There are a hell of a lot of people one just can't remember at all. But when one thinks of Kolbitz, there's a group of faces that immediately appear, chaps that, you know, you'll never forget. They, in essence, they were Kolbitz, you know, the leading lights of Kolbitz. And Mike Sinclair was, of course, amongst them.
You said that they're trying to build a glider. Can you tell me about that?
Yes. Well, this was a mad idea. Well, at least I thought it was a mad idea. The chaps concerned and one or two others didn't think it was so mad. But we had some gliding experts there. Lorne Welsh, for example, who was an RAF chap. had been a glider pilot before the war. He'd been gliding for some years before the war. And he was very much of a technical chap as well. Jack Best, who was an RAF flight lieutenant, he also had a lot of practical experience in gliding and in aircraft construction. He knew the technical side of it and understood, as Lorne did, the aerodynamics of this sort of thing. And there was a very small team involved, and of course they had to be experts. Douglas Bader was involved in it. Well, I suppose because of the morale value of having Douglas Bader, not because he was a practical man or knew anything about the construction of gliders. He wasn't engaged in the actual building of it. And of course, there are other people attached on the sidelines, as there were with any operation that was going on. But the scheme was to build a glider. It was only wanted for one purpose, and that was to get over the castle grounds, across the River Mulder, and as far as it would go beyond that, you see. So it's the limitation of its flight, or the flight envisaged for it, you know, was strictly limited, perhaps, at the most, perhaps half a kilometre. But the scheme was, well, we had to find somewhere to build a damn thing, and of course, chaps were always investigating the castle, saying, well, I wonder what the hell's behind this wall, or what's above this ceiling, or what have you. And of course, they took steps to find out what was beyond the wall or above this ceiling. And they found an attic, which was quite a sizable attic, completely unused, been unused for donkey's years, absolutely for donkey's years. But we knew it was visited from time to time by the Germans, and on their security rounds, but very, very rarely. I mean, one could tell that it was very rarely that it was visited. So it was decided to use this, and there was access from there, although somewhat difficult access, from there to the roof, to the gabled roof above. The first thing they did was to build a wall across, a false wall, leaving a space sufficient to build a glider, in the hope that when the casual visits by the Germans took place, you know, they'd open the door of this and look around and see, oh, that's empty, nothing there. You see, close the door and go out again, you see. And whether any Germans ever went up there after that, one just doesn't know. But the wall was built, and the materials were... They started assembling the materials, and of course the plans of the glider had been made very meticulously. The materials consisted of floorboards, and they were difficult. You had to have floorboards because of the length, and the only way to get floorboards was to pinch them from somewhere like an attic, and then lift up a lot more boards and fill up that missing space, so that instead of having one missing space, there were lots of tiny gaps, which, and dust scattered over them, nobody would notice that. Bedboards, shelves, anything, any suitable piece of wood that was available. Of course, tools had to be acquired, and we had acquired the tools through methods that we've already discussed, saws and whatever else was necessary. Wire, and the wire for the controls was largely electric wire. Of course, we had chaps who were skilled in, you know, virtually anything you can think of. You know, if I ripped an electric cable from a wall, and all the bloody lights would fuse, but these chaps could do that and make good the damage. In fact, instead of having two wires going down there, they could have one wire and get the same end result. The covering of the glider, what the hell do you call this stuff, the covering? This was going to be mattress covers. The mattresses on our bunks were good quality linen, very good quality linen. They were filled with wood shavings. One got used to the wood shavings. One got very used to them. One found them quite comfortable. But these mattress covers were absolutely ideal for this purpose. And again, our handmaidens got to work to cut them to size and to sew them and so on, which left the doping of the fabric. And this was a problem, and one looked around or tried to conjure up what one could use for doping. And this was solved in an unusual way. Dougie Bader, because his tin legs used to give him trouble from time to time, you know, like any bit of mechanism, the things used to go wrong and need adjusting or oiling, or whatever they do to tin legs. And in the village, in Colditz, was a small cycle shop, you know, the sort of cycle shop you'd find in any village. The sort of chap there who ran it, you give him a job to do and he'd do it. You know, nothing within reason was beyond his capabilities. And Douglas Bader, being Douglas Bader, and being in the unique position that he was in, and he was in a unique position in Germany, he was allowed down there, accompanied by a couple of sentries, once every so often, one for to exercise himself, because the complaint had been put into the German authorities time and again that it wasn't right that somebody like Bader with two tin legs should be. Have no exercise space except this cobbled courtyard, and the courtyard was cobblestone, you see. So Dougie used to go down there accompanied by a couple of sentries and visit the cycle shop and then go for a stroll around. Of course, the people in Colditz and Colditz village, they knew that Douglas Bader was there, and you know, one can imagine that they felt a sense of pride, because they, in their village, they'd got Douglas Bader. And he got to know various people down there. He came home on a number of occasions with his coat pockets filled with barley, just ordinary barley. And this was what was used for doping the fabric. The barley was boiled and boiled and boiled, and it made an absolutely excellent dope for the fabric. Well, this work went on for one hell of a long time. I can't remember how long it took. It was going on for one hell of a long time, and it kept, you know, kept the chaps interested. And to launch it, a ramp was going to be made up on the top of the gable here. And if you can picture that as a gable, a wooden ramp was going to be built up there
along the crest.
Yes, along the crest here. With a pulley, and the pulley itself would have to be made, a pulley at that end, and a strong rope, and a bloody great weight there. So, you know, here it is, with the ramp there, and a glider sitting on it there, and a glider back here with a long rope and the pulley there, and a bloody great weight. And at the moment it was used, when everything was ready, you push the weight over the side, and that would pull the glider along, and there was a release mechanism so that it had got enough lift at the end there to fly over the castle grounds, over the trees, across the river, and land, you know, as far away as possible.
So it was a falling weight that would give the necessary propulsion to launch it.
Absolutely, this was it, yes. And I was one of the doubtful people, and there must have been one hell of a lot of doubtful people who just could not see it working at all, you know. You saw clearly that the bloody thing was going to do the same as what happened with so many of these people who tried to fly with homemade wings and so on off one of the London bridges. They've gone straight down into the drink, and you know, this is what we envisaged for that. So
was it ever launched?
No, good God, no. I think, you know, the program worked out beautifully as I see it, and I'm sure even people like Lorne Welsh and Norman Forbes and the others must agree the thing worked out beautifully, because it was nearing its end. The glider itself was complete, and we only had the launching platform to make that final end of it to make when the Americans arrived, when the liberation forces arrived, you see. So, you know, that program worked out beautifully.
You said earlier that you were given an official position in the Kolditz camp. Can you tell me about that, what it involved?
Yes. No records were kept by our side of it in Kolditz. None whatsoever. I mean, we knew everybody there. We knew them by sight. We knew their names and so on. But there were no records. And the SBO, I'm not quite sure whether it was Colonel Todd or his predecessor as SBO, Daddy Steiner, who sent for me one day and said that we've got to start keeping records. The Germans have got full records of us, but we've got no records at all. You know, we've got nothing on paper at all. And after the war, people will want to know all sorts of things. The authorities will want to know all sorts of things. And we need to have the answers to show them. We need to be able to produce records, particularly the details of the chaps here. This was the basis of it, you see. So I was given that job to do, which primarily was to have a record of everyone in the camp